Hey, guys. Welcome to Building This Community.
This is your city business and policy development podcast. We're your hosts,
Luke Patrick
and Andrew Klump. Welcome to this week's episode of Building This Community. Our guest today is Maggie Kimberl, who is the president of the Bourbon Women Association and content editor for American Whiskey Magazine. Maggie, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me. How are you all doing today?
Oh, I'm hanging in there.
Doing great. Thanks so much for joining us today. And I know I just gave a brief background, but can you just go into a little bit more depth about your career?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so I've been in the industry for about 11 years now. I started off working part-time at the liquor store when my kids were little, and that was kind of my segue into this, and started meeting a lot of master distillers. I was really into the farm to table movement. And I thought, you know, maybe I should learn about this bourbon stuff because they make it from the corn that grows here and they make it right down the street from me. And so, you know, it was just kind of like a natural progression there. And I started off writing about whiskey. I was basically the bourbon beat writer for Louisville.com and covered a bunch of the different events and just kind of snowballed from there into covering, you know, the consumer side of the industry. And now I am covering, you know, a little bit more of the economic side of the industry as well.
Well, that's awesome. And I think it's pretty cool to start from, you know, from a retail sales position to work your way all the way up and find such an interest in bourbon. But
I guess I didn't cover the current part of that, which just started. So I'm now also currently the president of the Bourbon Women Association, which is a really fantastic consumer facing organization that is aimed at, you know, it's a twofold kind of mission. We're trying to improve the communication between brands and women, as well as giving women like kind of a better experience learning about whiskey and engaging with, you know, bourbon brands. And then the other side of that is we're supporting women in the industry.
So can you tell us a little bit about how Bourbon Women started, how the concept behind it and the goals? I think you just kind of laid that out, but how did all that get started?
Yeah, that's a great question. So 10 years ago, it's actually our 10th anniversary this year, which is really exciting. We're doing all kinds of anniversary programming around our 10th anniversary. But 10 years ago, Peggy Noe Stevens, who she spent, I think, 17 years working for Brown-Forman. She was the home place manager out at Woodford Reserve. And, you know, that was where she was trained. She was tapped by Lincoln Henderson, who was the father of Woodford Reserve, who went on to found Angel's Envy with his son and grandsons. He tapped her to become the first woman master taster in the Kentucky bourbon industry. And so that was, you know, her career trajectory went from, you know, being the home place manager to being the first woman master taster in the bourbon industry. And she quit doing that and started her own business doing consulting. You know, she works on a bunch of different distillery visitor centers now. And around that time, she thought, you know, gosh, the dialogue between brands and women is just, you know, it's either non-existent or not great. And wouldn't it be great if we could do something to improve that? And so what she ended up doing was, you know, she did some research and actually like had a focus group and everything and said, you know, this is my idea. What do you think? And ended up founding the Bourbon Women Association. And so, you know, it really was just, I think, born out of that frustration of, you know, why are brands ignoring women? Why are brands, you know, not able to have a better message for women? And she just really wanted to, you know, acknowledge women's roles and contributions to the Kentucky bourbon industry and, you know, later the broader American distilling industry. And, you know, really just give women consumers a place to say, you know, you're welcome here. We want you here. And it's not weird that you drink bourbon. It's actually quite normal. Lots of women drink bourbon. And you are here's a better way to engage with the brands and learn about the different topics that are interesting to you. So, you know, that whole history, like really it all just kind of boils down to, yes, women have been involved in the industry. Yes, women have been consumers. And we just need to, you know, better acknowledge both of those things.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's been really important. We've been seeing that over the past few decades, this growth into finally acknowledging women as a predominant role in history and trying to kind of grow their voice at the same time. But I feel like there have still been some industries that, you know, that have been standalones. And it's nice to see bourbon, that is primarily a masculine industry, transitioning more. Can you just tell us, since, you know, you're in charge of the Bourbon Women Association, more of that history of the industry and, you know, maybe any misnomers or misconceptions that could be there?
Yeah. And I mean, so one of them that you just said is that it's a masculine industry. And really, that just has not been the case. So, you know, historically, when we go back, even if we look at the Bible, women were brewers. And that was, you know, very well documented in the Old Testament. And so throughout history, really fermenting things was just a matter of home and hearth. So women would make beer, they would make wine. You know, eventually when distilling technology came around, they would do distilling. It was the same as canning and pickling and all those kinds of things. It was a way to preserve the harvest. So whenever anybody asks me, have there ever been any, you know, this kind of people in, you know, making whiskey or whatever, I say, well, you know, if they farmed and they lived in certain areas that had the technology, then yes, because it was really just an agricultural process. So I think it's really important to kind of take in the entire history of it. And I think the reason that a lot of people associate the distilled spirits industry with men is because, you know, again, that marketing just has not included women. And, you know, the histories have not included the women who have made the contributions. And throughout the, you know, so there, when you break it up in between the pre-industrial distilling, you know, when it was just a farm distillery kind of a thing or a matter of home and hearth, yes, pretty much everybody who did work on the farm would have been involved in that. There were plenty of women who were doing distilling, who were doing beer making, who were doing wine making during that period. And then once it started to become a regulated industry, there were still women who were running distilleries. So a perfect example of that was Mary Dowling, who owned the Waterfill and Fraser distillery in Tyrone, Kentucky, near modern day Wild Turkey. And that, she owned that distillery before Prohibition. She ran it. Her husband had passed away. She ran it herself. And when Prohibition came, she wasn't about to give up her industry. And so she packed up her still and grabbed a beam. We've got plenty of beams in Kentucky, and they're all in the distilling industry, it seems. And she went down to Juarez, Mexico, and started her distillery there, Waterfill and Fraser, and made bourbon in Mexico during Prohibition. So, you know, there are examples of women in all areas of the distilled spirits industry throughout history. They just maybe didn't get the recognition that other folks were getting. And so really, you know, it's a matter of, and if you want to read about any of these stories, by the way, my friend and colleague Fred Minnick wrote a fabulous book about 10 years ago called Whiskey Women, the Untold Story of How Women Saved, I think it was bourbon, scotch, and Irish whiskey. I can't remember what order the whiskeys were in the title, but he really did a lot of digging into the history of women at distilleries worldwide, not just in the United States, and found, I mean, there's a lot more history than I think a lot of people were acknowledging there. So that's a great resource if you want to go back and learn about the historical pieces of women in the distilled spirits industry. And, you know, really the nice thing about what's going on now in the industry is that people are saying, hey, you know, yes, women have been in this industry. Yes, people of color have been in this industry. And they're starting to acknowledge that and embrace it and say, you know, how do we tell this story authentically? And I think that's just been a really beautiful thing to see.
Well, that's honestly super interesting. And I think getting back to that branding thing, I traditionally, you know, growing up, I remember it being kind of at least targeted towards a masculine audience. And I'm super glad to see that kind of falling by the wayside and the audience for bourbon growing. But can you tell us, in general, that's just my anecdotal understanding, has bourbon as an industry been growing recently?
Oh, gosh, absolutely. I mean, so again, you have to kind of look at it through a historical lens to really understand where we are. So post-Prohibition, there was a big growth spurt that was kind of hampered by, you know, the Second World War. And well, a little bit by the First World War, significantly by the Second World War, because a lot of our distilleries within the United States were tasked with wartime production of ethanol. Ethanol was used in gunpowder, as antifreeze, lots of different ways to use ethanol, and it was needed for the military. And so that kind of put a little damper on the industry, but, you know, consumers were still buying whiskey. It was still a favorable market for whiskey. When you get into the 70s and the 80s, consumer palates changed significantly. You know, the beer industry, the wine industry were growing. They were very powerful. And, you know, the distilled spirits industry was maybe not as powerful. And the image of bourbon, because it had that image of being an old white man's drink or a blue collar drink, a working man's drink, it was not favorable. And then, you know, so spirits, if people drank spirits, it was usually in like kind of a fruity mixed cocktail. So it was a lot of rum and vodka and things like that. And so whiskey as a whole declined significantly. And so when you look at the growth that we have experienced in this industry in the last decade, it's always compared to the 60s or 70s. So I still... The Kentucky Distillers Association does an economic impact survey every other year to mark that. The last one they did, I believe, was in 2018. And, you know, they kind of put everything on hold last year. So I don't think that we have one for, you know, for 2020. We may have one this year. But when you look at those numbers, it's in comparison to the 70s. I still don't think that we have reached that the levels that we saw in the early 60s, as far as sales and volume being produced, but we're getting there. I mean, we're really close. So when I first started this, one of the benchmarks that people talk about is how many barrels are aging in a warehouse. When I first started 10 years ago, there was at least a 1-to-1 ratio of barrels to people in Kentucky. And then it was a 1-to-1 ratio of people and horses, which is a very Kentucky way to put that. And now it is a 2-to-1 ratio of people and horses, which is pretty significant.
Yeah, it seems like a heck of a lot of growth. And that recent growth over the last, you know, say 10 years or so, is there any way to tell, is it more foreign or domestic or both? Like who is buying up all this new bourbon?
Well, I mean, we have numbers on that. So the really interesting thing is the main market that kept Kentucky bourbon alive during the 80s was Japan and a little bit of Australia. There was an export market for bourbon, but Japan was one of the strongest ones. And so that's really interesting because you're starting to see Japanese companies that have come in and bought Kentucky distilleries and have partnered with Kentucky distilleries and have opened their own distilleries and brought people from Kentucky over to run them or teach their people how to run them. So during the 80s and early 90s, it was all Japan really keeping the Kentucky. And for that time, Four Roses was only available in Japan, which you couldn't even buy it in Kentucky, which was really interesting. When Jim Rutledge first became the master distiller, that was one of the first things that he asked for was, you know, our people are making this and they can't even buy it. Can we, you know, maybe at least start selling it in Kentucky, which is just completely wild to think of in retrospect. But you've only been able to buy Four Roses bourbon in Kentucky since the 80s in the last really 10, 15 years. So that's really interesting. So really in the 90s, from the 90s on, when the growth started taking place, it's really taking place within the United States. One of the things that has been really unfortunate is there has been a lot of work toward selling American distilled spirits in the European market. And because of the trade war and the tariffs, a lot of that has fallen to almost completely zero for many brands, which is, you know, it's been really tragic because a lot of the smaller craft distilleries out in the United States, you know, mostly outside of Kentucky, where they don't, you know, they're maybe not as strong, they're not as old, they don't have as much whiskey aging and history to draw from and things like that. You know, they had really made a name for themselves exporting into the European market. And when that kind of got closed off because of the tariffs, that really hurt. I mean, it actually put some people out of business. It hurt a lot of people significantly. You know, there, I've talked to distillery owners who were talking about expanding. And as soon as that happened, they were like, you know, we have to put all this money back into finding other markets because, you know, we spent all this money trying to open up this market. We have these special bottles, you know, the bottles are different sizes in the European market. So we have all this inventory of bottles that we now can't use. And it really hurt a lot of people. But overall, the most significant growth in the distilled spirits industry has been within the United States over the last decade.
Interesting. And I think that's something you talked about the tariffs, you talked about the growth in demand. How does the industry that bourbon in particular, whiskey in particular, where the distillation process is so long, how do they keep up with just the rising demand when it takes so long to produce the product?
So, I mean, that's kind of a running joke, right? Because people will ask master distillers, like, when are you going to have more of this next year? And, you know, they always laugh and say, you know, if we would have had a crystal ball, we would have made a lot more. And so, you know, it's like kind of just a funny quip that they've come up with, because you're absolutely right. You know, it's not necessarily the distillation process, it's the maturation process. And so you make this stuff and then it has to sit in a barrel for, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12, 15 years, whatever your product requires. And you don't know. I mean, the distilleries that are keeping up with demand right now are the ones who said, you know what, we feel like there's going to be growth. So we're going to make a little bit more this year. We're going to make a little bit more next year. We're going to make a little bit more the year after that. But there are a lot of distilleries that really just didn't even have the capacity. One of the interesting things that I've seen is, you know, the first time I went to Maker's Mark was before I was in the industry at all. I went when my son was a year old. He was in a stroller. I was pushing my baby around Maker's Mark Distillery in a stroller. And they had the setup that they had since however long, 30, 40 years or whatever. And by the time I started writing about whiskey, which would be about 5 years later, they had doubled capacity. Within a couple of years after that, they had quadrupled capacity. So they added more fermenters, more stills, you know, and every time they added, they wanted to keep the same sizes so that everything would be proportional. And so they doubled by adding more. I think they had 8 fermenters and then they went to 16 fermenters there, but they stayed the same size. They had the still size, they had Vendome make the exact same still, and it was basically a mirror image on the other side of the wall. And then they did the same thing, they quadrupled. So they went from 16 to I think 32 and then, you know, added additional still space. And so it's really interesting because a lot of the distilleries were at capacity and they've had to increase capacity significantly. So that has lent itself to a major construction and fabrication boom in our Commonwealth. There are distilleries that are breaking ground on a new rick house every 4 months. Buffalo Trace, and it's like a 30,000 barrel capacity rick house every 4 months that they're putting up. So Buffalo Trace recently bought a farm across the river from their distillery, and they're breaking ground for a new rick house every 4 months. I think it's a 30,000 barrel capacity warehouse every 4 months. Vendome Copper and Brass Works here in Kentucky makes, before this boom, they were the only people making commercial still equipment in the United States. And if you wanted a still from somewhere else, you had to go to Scotland, to Forsyth's, or to Germany, to Kurta. And, you know, it's been really interesting because Vendome has been cranking out stills. You know, they have a 9 month to a year waiting list to get a still. So it's been really significant seeing the growth that has happened, because it wasn't just like they said, okay, let's make some more whiskey. It was like, well, gosh, how do we make more whiskey? We need to add capacity to even make that happen.
I really like to hear that, especially with the Bourbon Trace comment. Growing up in Frankfurt, I'd love to see that part of the town get a little bit more love and have some construction going on.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been fabulous to see. And it's so beautiful. You know, you go up, they did a really nice job of, you know, they put like a little, I guess you would call it like a bird's nest up in the top of the rickhouse. So you can go up all the flights of stairs, which is, you know, great cardio, of course. But you get up there and there's like this little bird's nest where you can look out on the whole farm and then across the river and see the distillery. And it's just really gorgeous to go up there and see all of that.
Oh, yeah. No, it's beautiful. No question. So we've seen bourbon growing over these last few years. But at the same time, I've noticed all kinds of hip gin bars, you know, celebrity tequila companies are popping up all over the place. You know, higher end scotch is just incredibly hard to find now. It feels like the liquor industry in general is just replete with options today. How do you think bourbon competes and stands out in that crowded field?
Well, so that's a really great question. When you're talking about the celebrity tequilas and the celebrity rums and things like that, there is a lot of backlash on those products specifically because of the questions of cultural appropriation. And, you know, really, they're different markets from the people that I'm talking to when I'm doing my writing and my lecturing and my classes. You know, I'm talking to people, whiskey consumers are very different from, you know, consumers of general spirits. So a lot of times the growth in things like celebrity tequilas and celebrity rums and things like that is really influencer driven. When you get into whiskey consumers, it's really driven by a need or a want for authenticity, that farm to table movement that we talked about. You know, it's really all about having that authentic backstory. And that doesn't mean that only the distilleries that have been around 150 years have an authentic backstory. Everybody has an authentic backstory, you know, it's just a matter of like, how do you find that? How do you tell that? And so, you know, when I talk to folks at smaller distilleries, I hear a lot of the same stories echoed. You know, we really loved Kentucky bourbon, but we knew that we couldn't compete with it. So we tried to figure out what was authentic to us. And, you know, they looked at the history of their local region and the agriculture in their local region, and they tried to figure out a way to tie that into their story. And so that's where we're seeing a lot of growth in categories like American single malt, because, you know, particularly in the northern part of the United States, barley malt grows a lot better and corn does not. So if you were going to make a bourbon in Portland, Oregon, you would have to truck in corn from the Midwest. Whereas the other side of that is there's already an existing brewery culture there making beer. And so barley malt is everywhere. You can get it very easily. And so I visited, the last place that I went before the pandemic shut everything down was Westward in Portland, Oregon. And everybody who worked at that distillery had a background in beer making and working in breweries. And so they made an American single malt that it's not peated, it's not smoked, it is aged in charred new oak barrels. And, you know, it's just, they focused on creating a very clean beer process on the front end. And that really comes out in the end distillate. So it's really, you know, consumers of whiskey generally are not following you know, trends that are being pushed by influencers. They're really looking for that authenticity and that, you know, tie to something that they care about, the farm to table movement, you know, the locavore movement, you know, local farming communities, and, you know, just really tying that into something that is authentic.
Yeah, I think that's something that you're starting to see with, you know, millennials and Gen Z that is just really pushing for their products to be more natural, more authentic. You know, I mean, was Tito's vodka even became extremely popular because they were one of the first ones to say that they were, what was it, gluten-free vodka? I mean, so, and they slapped that on their label. So you're starting to see younger generations kind of crave that. So I think you make a really good point there.
But to that point, though, I have to point out a couple of things. So number one is, you know, bourbon, because of the strict laws around it, cannot have anything added to it. So that plays into, you know, people looking for authenticity, and, you know, they know what's in it. They know that there's nothing added to it that shouldn't be there. So when you buy a bourbon, a straight Kentucky bourbon, especially, you know what's in it, you know what's in the bottle, and you know that there's nothing in there that's going to surprise you. Tito's, on the other hand, actually got into a little bit of legal trouble early on for I think they had made a claim that they were handmade, and they in fact ended up not being. I think that they were buying GNS from another GNS is grain neutral spirit, and then distilling that further, or I can't remember exactly what it was, but they did have a little bit of controversy early on for co-opting some of those, concerns that you're absolutely right, millennials and Gen Z have about the products that they buy.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I want to get more like pinned down on this competition, though, in that, you know, we actually had our second guest on this podcast was Albrecht Stommer in Singapore, and he was talking about how much bourbon and scotch like soared in Singapore and East Asia while he was over there. And I guess what we never came to the conclusion, like, do we think, or do you think that bourbon can ever get that high end price point that scotch has?
Oh, that's a great question. I love that question, because that's something we talk about all the time. So again, it goes back to this perception where, you know, bourbon for a long time was seen as being a working man's drink, a blue collar drink. And really, one of the major drivers behind the growth was there were people at Kentucky distilleries who were looking at the Scotch world. Because, you know, there had been a lot of change in perception of scotch. Before single malt scotch became popular, it had to be made popular. So scotch, you know, in the, I think, 40s, 50s, and 60s, maybe into the 70s, you wanted a blended scotch because that was seen as the way that scotch was supposed to be. Single malt scotches had a lesser image, if you will. And then someone came along and said, but no, this is good because it's single malt. And then, you know, they pushed that narrative, and then single malt scotch became what was desirable over a blended scotch. Mm-hmm. And so distillers in Kentucky had seen that narrative play out and said, you know what? There's no reason why bourbon should be on a lesser playing field than scotch, either blended or single malt. And so they said, you know, we need to figure out, and I think at the time, one of the major drivers of that was Buffalo Trace. But, you know, all the distilleries have worked very cooperatively to push that narrative together to say, you know what, this is actually very high quality stuff. And they went out, and it was really just a matter of all those master distillers all those years ago going out and pounding the pavement and saying, you know, this is just as good, or, you know, this appeals to this palate, or, you know, the just really flipping the script, if you will, on what bourbon is and what it was. So it was really just on both counts, between scotch and bourbon. Both of those were marketing campaigns, really, it when it boils down to it.
So do you think that, so you think that bourbon could kind of match the scotch skyrocket in price?
I think it absolutely is starting to. I mean, there are definitely bourbons. Well, so the flip side of that, though, is there's a difference in maturation between scotch and bourbon. So you can't have a bourbon that is as old as a scotch and still have it be good. And there are a couple of different reasons for that. So, you know, bourbon has a sweet spot. Really, 8 to 12 years is the sweet spot. And there are exceptions in both directions. I've actually had 1-year-old bourbon that was phenomenal. And I've had some 15 and 20-year-old bourbon that was phenomenal. Generally, once you get past 15 years, it's going to be a little bit overly tannic unless you have been really babying that barrel for all that time. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that we will see, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Scotch, on the other hand, you know, bourbon is aged in charred new oak barrels. So you get a lot of that barrel flavor into that whiskey pretty quickly. Scotch, on the other hand, is generally aged in used cooperage. And so this is going to be, emptied bourbon barrels and wine casks, and, you know, think casks that have had other things in them. And so you're not getting as much of that flavor. And then climate wise, when you're looking at the difference between Kentucky and Scotland, you know, Scotland just doesn't get as hot as Kentucky in the summertime. And so that really changes, again, the amount of those wood notes that get into that whiskey. So you're already starting off with less wood notes in that whiskey because it's a used barrel. And then you add in the climate difference that is doing even less. There's a little bit less evaporation because, you know, it does not get as hot. The water doesn't evaporate as readily. And so you can have higher age on a scotch. By the time it gets to be, you know, over 20 years old, there's less of it in a barrel. And so that is one of the reasons why it commands a higher price, is just because of the scarcity. And, you know, all of that kind of plays into, you know, the differential in the pricing. Now, what we're starting to see is there are distilleries that are saying, you know what, we're going to intentionally place this barrel in a colder environment and keep it there while it ages. Or, you know, we're going to place it on a lower level of the warehouse and see how long we can keep it there until it needs to be bottled. And so there's a lot of that intentionality going on in the industry now to try to make something that is maybe a little bit older, a little bit more rare in the future.
Yeah, no, I think that makes perfect sense. And, you know, I think it's just going to be, time will tell when it comes to whether or not bourbon actually can catch up with scotch in that department. So the other thing is, you know, I personally am a fan of cocktails, especially bourbon cocktails. Do you see that as, you know, I guess more, maybe more on the lower end, but do you see that as key to getting people into bourbon that may not traditionally drink it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of different ways to approach distilled spirits, and cocktails are probably one of the more popular ones. And really, the cocktail culture, you know, there was a big push. So back in the 60s, the space age, if you will, there was this push toward convenience, to making everything easy. And one of the things that my friend Steven at the Fraser Museum brought up the other day was that his parents would have this powdered mix, and they would put it in the blender with some whiskey, and that would be their whiskey sour. And then, you know, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, you started to see these shelf-stable neon green sweet and sour mixers. And so that was really what gave a lot of cocktails, particularly whiskey cocktails, a bad name, because, like, you know, people kind of forgot how to make them because they thought that, you know, you're just supposed to get some mix while you're at the liquor store and mix it all together. And so there was this movement toward the craft cocktails, you know, actually getting back to the original recipes for these cocktails. You know, instead of using a sweet and sour mix, it's literally just lemon juice, simple syrup, and an egg white. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's really all that's in it. But people were intimidated by that. And you don't even have to use the egg white. That's really just, that gives it a better texture. But you can make a whiskey sour with lemon juice or any kind of citrus juice. I actually make it with lime juice and a little bit of simple syrup, and then your whiskey. And then, you know, it's a beautiful drink when you really just strip it down to those basic components. And so the craft cocktail movement was really what brought rye whiskey back, because for a long time, you know, rye whiskey was just not popular at all. You know, at Wild Turkey, Jimmy Russell would say, you know, well, we made it one day a year, and then it started getting popular, so we started making it 2 days a year, you know? And so it was really just a matter of, like, nobody was drinking rye whiskey at all. And, you know, so they weren't making it. And then it started to become more popular. So I think now, you know, Wild Turkey's probably making it 2 weeks a year. And then there are lots of other rye whiskeys on the market now, whereas 10 years ago, it was pretty much Sazerac, Wild Turkey rye. I think Jim Beam maybe had a rye, but really nobody was making rye whiskey. But the craft cocktail movement was really what brought that back from the brink of extinction.
Well, I think among this growing cocktail culture, I'd like to see bourbon take a center stage there. And I don't think I'm alone. I think the state has leaned into marketing, you know, particularly the bourbon trail as a tourism selling point. Do you think that the bourbon trail has had the success that the distillers hoped when they created it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so the Kentucky Bourbon Trail proper as we know it has really only been around for, I think last year was the 21st anniversary. I seem to recall that last year was kind of weird for everybody. And they were planning all these, you know, 21st birthday celebrations for obvious reasons that didn't happen.
That's
but,
funny.
You know, really it was after Prohibition, all of the distillers came together and said, you know, if we don't want this to happen again, then we need to band together and kind of self-govern and self-regulate so that we don't end up in the same position that caused this to begin with. And, you know, the reason that it happened to begin with was because, you know, there was a lot of drunkenness going on and, you know, a lot of bad things coming from that. And so there are reasons why Prohibition was able to take hold and that it seemed to make sense to people at the time. And, you know, once that was over and they realized that their experiment failed, the distiller said, you know, how about if we just are really mindful of who we're marketing to and that we're telling people to be responsible? You know, the responsibility narrative has really been one of the reasons why we have not seen, you know, such an uptick in you know, the kinds of behaviors that led to Prohibition before. And actually, you know, there was a study that came out from responsibility.org a few weeks back that showed that, you know, drunk driving was at an all-time low and that, you know, childhood use of alcohol, you know, alcohol use by teenagers was at an all-time low. And, you know, these are a lot of the things that the associations, you know, the Kentucky Distillers Association's DISCUS and all those other things were pushing for because they wanted to make sure that they didn't end up in the same boat that they were in that caused Prohibition. And so really, you know, the cooperativeness of the industry as a whole has kept the industry alive. But then when they banded together and said, hey, maybe we should start, you know, enticing people to come here and travel, you know, it was already a very strong association that they made even stronger through those efforts to promote tourism.
So in terms of the tourism promotion aspect of it, is there a way to determine the economic impact of either the traditional bourbon trail or even Louisville's urban bourbon trail? And if so, maybe what is that impact, if you know?
Yeah, so I've got the general impact study up. So these are numbers that they published in 2019. And so distilling contributes $8.6 billion to Kentucky's economy, a 60% increase since 2009. More than 20,120 people owe their paychecks to the spirits industry, a 104% increase in the last 10 years, and 2,600 more since 2016. Payroll for those workers increased to more than $1 billion from $442 million in 2009. The distilling has the second highest job multiplier in the state when it comes to total number of jobs and spinoff factor, behind only light trucking and utility vehicle manufacturing. So for every distillery job, we're spinning off multiple jobs in travel and tourism and restaurants and bars and all of those different areas. So it's really, you know, yes, we have numbers on that. We know that the impact of this industry in the Commonwealth of Kentucky is significant. You know, one of the things that I like to point people to was when I was a kid, it was all about coal and tobacco. And as those things kind of fell off, you know, we were in trouble in the late 80s, early 90s, the Kentucky economy. I don't know if you all really, really remember that, but, you know, our Kentucky economy was in a great deal of trouble at that point. And really the success and amazing growth of the distilled spirits industry within the Commonwealth of Kentucky is what has saved our economy. And, you know, that's something that I don't take lightly as some, as a lifelong Kentuckian whose family is from here for generations. You know, I don't take that lightly. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so adamant about supporting the continued growth of this industry, because it is so important to our economy.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It is integral to the development of Kentucky. But to kind of hit the inverse of that, should Kentucky feel threatened by other states jumping in on the bourbon industry? And, you know, are we in a bad position if we put too much of our economy into bourbon?
I mean, that's certainly something to consider. You know, yes, I think that we need to be looking at supporting and bolstering other areas of the economy. You know, that's something I don't think we have control over within the bourbon industry. The only thing that the bourbon industry can really control is the bourbon industry. But I certainly encourage and support any other areas of economic growth within the Commonwealth. And I think you're absolutely right. That's something that, you know, business leaders need to be cognizant of. We definitely don't want to put all of our eggs in one basket. As far as, you know, does the Kentucky Distillers Association or the Bourbon Trail or anything like that, or the industry as a whole, should it feel threatened by growth outside of Kentucky? At this point, it's still so tiny compared to the output that we are making. You know, Kentucky and Tennessee have been producing all of America's whiskey and MGP in Indiana. But this, you know, this corridor has been responsible for all of the whiskey production for so long that, you know, there's just no way that any other state can touch us at this point. You know, as they grow and they grow those export markets, you know, there may be some consideration there down the line. But right now, there are so many export markets that have yet to be opened up. You know, we were in a really good position before the trade war where a lot of the smaller distilleries were able to go in and open up those markets in other countries. That has really contracted significantly. So, you know, really the biggest thing that we need to do to make sure that it's not a threat is to address the tariffs and address the trade war, because that is the thing that is hurting the industry as a whole the most. And, you know, if we can flip that switch, then we can, you know, work cooperatively to ensure that America remains a powerhouse for distilled spirits into the future.
Yeah, I agree. I think that makes perfect sense. And I appreciate you going in depth on the policy for us and the economics for us. But I want to ask maybe the most important question, since you are the expert on bourbon here on this panel. How do you drink your bourbon? Because I think that should impact how everyone else here decides to drink theirs.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you should do everything exactly the way that I do it, because, you know, that's the only, no, the nice thing about this industry is, you know, it is very open and it is very welcoming. I have never felt like, you know, I was doing anything wrong or I wasn't welcome. And that includes the way that I drink my bourbon. I do drink my bourbon neat. I like higher proof bourbons. I drink them out of a Glencairn glass. But I also like cocktails. I really love a great Manhattan. I love a really good whiskey sour with an egg white in it. And, you know, there's no wrong way. Find what works for you and go for it. And if you want to try it my way, I'm happy to share.
That honestly sounds pretty good. I might have to try the whiskey sour.
Yeah. But, oh, yeah, definitely.
Maggie, this has been a great conversation. Before we let you go, we want to give you a chance to plug anything. Are you working on any projects or anything else you'd like to promote?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, obviously, I would love it if you would subscribe to American Whiskey Magazine, because, you know, I have been helping grow the content of that magazine since it started 4 years ago. And, you know, I'm just really proud of the work that we're doing there. Other thing that I'm doing right now that I'm super proud of is I am doing a series on the Bourbon Women blog called Meet the Makers. So if you go to bourbonwomen.org, and you click on our community, you'll see a little button there for Meet the Makers. And what I'm doing there is I'm profiling women who are working in the distilled spirits industry, because again, I want to challenge that misnomer that only men are working in this industry. You would not believe the volume of emails and messages that I'm getting saying, can you profile this person? Can you profile this person? Can you profile this person? I am looking at, you know, I'm staring down probably a year's worth of content if I put these out once a week without even having to struggle to find anybody to talk about. And that's pretty significant. I think that that really proves definitively that women are a huge part of this industry, and that maybe they're just not getting the light shown on them as much as possible. And so that's something that I am wanting to do, to really place the spotlight on women in this industry and say, yes, we are here. We've been here. We're going to be here. And this is what we're doing. So bourbonwomen.org, check that out.
Okay, that's pretty cool. But okay, we've got to wrap it up. Before we let you go, we like to ask all of our guests this final question. If you had the power to change one policy in Louisville, just snap your fingers and have it happen, what would it be?
Ooh, gosh, that's a really tough one. You know, I love Louisville, and I think that there are a lot of things that we could be doing differently. And I really just think that when we're talking about business policies, I would like to see, you know, a greater emphasis on supporting businesses owned by people of color and revitalizing areas of town that have been neglected for a really long time. As far as, you know, what I deal with personally on a day-to-day basis, I would like to see an allowance made for cigar lounges.
That's pretty interesting. And I couldn't agree with you more on focus on traditionally marginalized communities or parts of the city. We've talked extensively about the West End and you know, what we'd like to see done to improve the conditions there.
Yeah, and we really appreciate you hopping on here, Maggie.
Absolutely, yeah, thanks so much for having me, you all.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking the time.
Absolutely.
We'll pick back up with our reaction segment after a word from our sponsor.
Well, Luke, that was another interesting interview with Maggie Kimbrell. I think she had such good perspective on bourbon, on women, on the industry, both like economics and production. There's a lot that just kind of stood out to me, but what stood out to you?
Honestly, I was happy to have her kind of blow up my conception of women in the industry because mm-hmm. it was wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I like hearing somebody write, you know, a portion of history that I maybe misunderstood, that I think a lot of people misunderstood, that maybe the industry has portrayed in a misleading manner. And I'm glad to see her and bourbon women taking, you know, a stand and making an effort to try and emphasize the role that women have played going all the way back to, you know, the beginnings of this industry.
Well, and I think that's something we're starting to see in industries across the country, right, or across the world. And that, like, for example, horse racing is trying to emphasize and explain the role of Black people throughout their history now, like the Derby Museum and things like that, that it's becoming so much more important on different industries and to explain what the true history was and what the real role of people were in the growth and creation of a particular industry. So I think the work she's doing is absolutely integral to that. And I think she's doing an unbelievable job to kind of help grow that with everyone else in the industry that's starting to look towards that as well.
Yeah. And honestly, in both instances, it's kind of upsetting to think that, like, it wasn't necessarily like a passive thing. Like, it wasn't that people just forgot that women were involved or that African-Americans were involved in the horse industry. The industries took action to kind of market themselves in a way that portrayed them as kind of masculine or you know, predominantly white, you know? And so it's good that nowadays we're starting to give recognition to the people that played a role in getting us to where we are.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And recognizing who those people were and giving their place in history.
And it's so, honestly, going back to the early days of like women being like the first fermenters, it being kind of like a homebrew thing. A part of me maybe knew that that was the case, like way back, you know, in ancient times, like the first distillers, the first brewers. Mm-hmm. I knew that women did take a role back then. But something in my mind, I just thought there was like a cutoff point where like they stopped being as involved in the industry. And it was good to have like my misconception challenged and you know, be told like the accurate history that like they've really always been there, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm glad to see that now they're getting the recognition that, you know, they deserve.
Yeah.
But in terms of like changes to the industry, like in terms of righting the wrong, you know, of those misconceptions and false advertisings, maybe the false marketing concepts that, you know, bourbon has been built on. I also want to talk about changes in the industry. I wonder what kind of impact COVID has had. And, you know, obviously the marketing study that Maggie was relying on, it wasn't conducted last year because of COVID. So it's hard to get a snapshot of what economically is going on or what impact that has had on bourbon. I kind of worry, you know, what might have happened. You know, I really would love it if there was data. You know, obviously we'll see in the coming years, you know, what transpired, but it's just something to consider.
Well, I worry in particularly, we mentioned this in the interview, right, is that cocktails are the gateway, I think, for people trying to get into bourbon, you know, especially if you're getting more like a citrus that can cut some of that bitterness from the bourbon or the bite, then people may be more interested or maybe more willing to try bourbon out at cocktail bars and or bars generally. And with COVID and having bars being shut down, I just find it probably less likely that people that are newish to bourbon going out to the liquor store that when they're drinking at home, picking up bourbon as opposed to picking up a pack of seltzers or picking up vodka or something else that's easy rather than just trying it. Like, those are just so much more approachable than bourbon if you're not into bourbon.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's hard to imagine somebody mm-hmm. that doesn't drink bourbon just showing up at a liquor store and picking up a bottle.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
But like, it's so much easier to try a cocktail. Maybe if it has other flavors that you enjoy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The description can be very helpful there and try and get people more into bourbon. The other thing though with that too is we don't really know the impact yet either, but obviously COVID has been hard on a lot of downtowns. Louisville in particular has really pushed this whole bourbonism thing. And I think it's a great branding tool for Louisville. Some people are sick of it. And I kind of get that a little bit. I do worry about putting all of our eggs in one basket. You know, if we put all our tourism and focus on bourbon and then bourbon tanks, then we could be kind of stuck.
Yeah. In the same way that we were hit when the tobacco lawsuit, you know, mm-hmm. hurt the tobacco industry, we were heavily reliant on that, you know? And so like we did experience that as a state, or we have experienced that as a state before. And it's almost strange to see us in a similar sense, putting so much emphasis on, you know, a single or just a couple industries.
But it's what we have and it's what's unique to Kentucky, what's unique to Louisville. So like, that is the important thing that you have to harp on. You have to do what is unique to draw people here.
Yeah. And I honestly don't think it's the worst idea. I think you can kind of couple the bourbon tourism with kind of ag tourism or ecotourism mm-hmm. throughout the state. I think we've got one of the most beautiful states. We've got a plethora of farmland, gorgeous mountains, some amazing state parks like Red River Gorge, Natural Bridge. Like, these are areas, and we've seen an interest in that, mm-hmm. a growing interest. In fact, I think there's plans for like a massive like tourist camping conglomeration or something to be
placed. A resort.
Yeah, a resort. Okay, yeah, I won't make it sound so negative. A resort to be placed on the edge of the Red River Gorge to try and drive tourism.
And you're seeing Gil Holland and others trying to go into Eastern Kentucky to put in more developments there and try and drive tourism to those, you know, beautiful mountainscapes.
Exactly. So, you know, and that's something that like it pairs so well with the bourbon trail, which, mm-hmm. you know, is taking you through some of the most gorgeous parts of the state, that you definitely do want to have that emphasis on bourbon. But I want to see it coupled with like other aspects that can grow tourism, you know, drive people into our state.
I think that's very fair. But I also think that just having the industries downtown has been so huge, because before, if you just had nothing but the regular distilleries, the more rustic, you know, out on farmland, like that's a great experience. But the urban experience is unique too. And I think it's also pushed for more innovation. Like she talked about how they're trying to have maybe even looking like temperature controlled. You know, I know the old Forester Distillery downtown has a completely like air conditioned still house, right? So it's kind of pushing for innovation, but it's also like really driving people to get access that don't want to drive 40 minutes. They can, it's right there. They come visit the city. They can hit 1, 2, 3, 4, find the history of different bourbons and not have to go a 40, 50 minute drive to different distilleries. So yeah, it has increased the access to it, which I think has been a huge component of the entire industry.
And honestly, some of the distilleries downtown are gorgeous. I think the architecture on them, I mean, like, I think they improve our skyline, make the city look great. You know, I do appreciate the growth that's happened throughout the city with that regard, you know.
So, but then how much should Kentucky be looking to protect the industry?
That's a pretty good question. You know, it feeds pretty well into the paper we picked for this week. It's titled Champagne, Feta, and Bourbon, the Spirited Debate About Geographical Indications. And the paper basically analyzes the framework for trademark protections at the international level. Mm-hmm. And like there's a floor level of protection that all parties to the WTO's TRIPS agreement have agreed to, which is almost all, I think, member states of the World Trade Organization. And so I think specifically for this paper, it looks at the protections that different countries afford above and beyond those base level protections. Mm-hmm. And it uses like the examples of the United States and the European Union, which have taken pretty substantially different approaches to protecting GIs, geographical indications, which are products that have, the legalese sense of it, a land quality nexus. So mm-hmm. basically, they're products that come from a specific geographic region, and supposedly that region has certain qualities that will influence the product. And oftentimes the argument is made produce a higher quality product. So you can think of things like Idaho potatoes or like Irish whiskey, you know. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes the geographical distinction is made in the name, you know. And you can see things like champagne in France gets so many protections afforded to it. They basically have a monopoly established by French law and European law to be the only ones in the world that can produce a product called champagne. They've taken it as far as preventing perfume makers from, like French perfume makers, from using the name champagne.
Wow.
Like, they have insane levels of protection. And it's just a different approach than we've taken here in the United States. We've offered, you know, an expansion of trademark law, things like collective marks or credential marks. And these things do afford a slightly higher degree of protection than like just general trademarking law. But really, it's nothing compared to the French approach. I mean, in things like the Bordeaux wine region, you know, the French government has an entire bureaucracy that is policing the production, almost every stage of the production of that wine. Things from the growth quotas per hectare of you know, farmland, the temperature requirements at every stage of production, mm-hmm. Bottling requirements, labeling requirements, things that, you know, you definitely don't see in America. I mean, we have a list of rules that, you know, you must satisfy to you know, call a product bourbon. You know,
yeah.
But it's like you've got to check like four boxes, you
yeah.
know, and in France, you have like basically a policeman, you know, standing over you, you know, like some French bureaucrat that's telling you basically everything you need to do in every step of production. It's a level of government involvement that we don't have here. And although we don't have those same type of protections where, you know, only sparkling wine produced in the Champagne region can be called champagne here in America, you know, you can produce bourbon anywhere in the United States.
And I think that's a good thing. We could do, you know, Kentucky distillers could maybe push and say, well, you know, I think anybody that's ever been on a distillery tour will tell you that the limestone, quote unquote, in Kentucky is the reason that makes our water so good, which is what makes our bourbon so good.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we could try and make some sort of claim that way for protection. But quite honestly, I think the bourbon in other areas helps drive innovation here. And they're not really a threat at this point. At least that's what Maggie was telling us. I think it's fine. I think it's healthy competition is fine.
Well, that's the classic free market argument, is it's going to the freer the market, like the greater the competition, like the more drive on the part of the producers mm-hmm. to create a superior product. And, you know, even though we don't afford the same protections to bourbon as, you know, France does to its winemakers, we still have a scenario where Kentucky bourbon is kind of the standard against, you know, or that all others, you know, would measure their product against. And so even though we don't afford that same level of protection, it's something like over 90% of bourbon is produced in Kentucky, you know? Yep. And so there maybe is some kind of land quality nexus in Kentucky that does produce, you know, a greater quality bourbon, but we don't need to impose some kind of archaic, you know, legal structure to entrench that.
We have the culture.
Consumers. Yeah. Uh-huh.
We have the culture.
Yeah. We have the culture.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, consumers have seemingly made their choice, you know?
Well, and that's certainly interesting. And it'll be interesting to see too where this goes into the future and to see maybe if there's additional competition or if the Kentucky distillers want to try and get those protections in the future. I don't really foresee that happening, but it will definitely be something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I thought it was just interesting to look at the different approaches that, you know, different countries have taken. And personally, I'm comfortable with the way that we've grown. And I think our industry is, you know, as strong as it's ever been.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Luke, do you have any other topics you want to hit?
No, I just one more time, I want to thank Maggie for coming out. I thought that was a great interview.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for tuning in, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot. As always, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for joining us on Building This Community. If you'd like any more information, you can follow us on Twitter at buildingthiscom.com, or you can follow Andrew
at Andrew J. Klump. And you can also follow Luke
at LMP43. Definitely subscribe, and we look forward to talking to you guys next week.